I'll be brief. As most of the committee is aware, the November forecast showed a $426 million deficit in this current year. The governor asked agencies and the executive branch to look at a 10% reduction in their current year operating budgets, specifically non-grant funds for the Department of Health that came to $1.7 million. We were asked to present a plan on how we would provide or unallot those funds by January 2nd. And in essence, the long and the short of it is that we provided a plan through management decisions of using one-time savings, balances for projects, and salary savings going forward to accommodate the reduction without any layoffs in this current year. So I'd be happy to take any questions about that, Madam Chair.
It doesn't sound like anything you're doing is going to be helpful in terms of solving this biennium's problem.
Madam Chair, I would say that no. The reduction in the current year, other than drawing down the deficit overall for the total biennium, didn't do anything that had lasting impacts into the tails.
Are there any questions? We'd like to have you give us specifically by an allotment where the reductions were made by amount. You may not have that with you right now. I don't know. But we'd like you to give us that.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to provide that.
Any other questions? Thank you, then. Jane Rankin.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jane Rankin. I'm the budget director at the Department of Human Services. And you have in your packet a one-page handout from us entitled Human Services Fiscal Year 2009 Unallotment. It summarizes for the Department of Human Services, there were two aspects to the unallotment. There was $73 million, which was included in the governor's unallotment action from last December. And that came from a variety of programs, grants.
We don't need that. Balances. That was pretty clear in the unallotment letter.
Okay.
So what we need to know is your 10% central office reductions, where they're coming from.
Okay. Madam Chair, for the central office reductions, the department's target was $6 million. And we came to that level of savings for the fiscal 9 year primarily from central office agency-wide savings that we had been managing towards for the past year. It was, as you heard from the Department of Health, it was salary savings, because in part because of the soft hiring restrictions that we have been under since a year ago. It was also by generally managing towards managing the agency's administrative actions with an eye towards the environment where we knew that the state's fiscal situation was going to be challenging, so we were careful not to overcommit. And so to anticipate the question that you asked of the Department of Health, the savings that we provided for the administrative unallotment are basically also one time and would not would not make a structural change in our budget that would carry forward into the 10-11 biennium.
Well, I don't exactly understand that. If some of the savings came because of not filling vacancies, then those vacancies still aren't filled, are they? I mean, and when you don't fill a vacancy from outside, sometimes you move people around inside. I guess I was expecting, you know, a bit more specifics here.
Madam,
you can also give us information, as I asked for the department, from the Department of Health for an allotment by line item.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I will get that information for you. I'm trying to think about how best to characterize where the money came from for unallotment to answer your question. We had an account in the central office that we used to manage agency-wide pressures and policies. For example, when I get back the information that you're asking for, you will see that one line item will indicate that there's savings taken from laptop replacement. We had money in the 09 budget because we have a cycle of how often we replace the computer, the technology for the central office staff. And because we have been tightly managing our administrative expenses and complement, we had funds there that we could take for this one-time purpose of the unallotment.
How much was
so
that?
That was $350,000.
Okay, then we've only got $5,800,000 to go.
That's correct. And as I said, I will get more information back for the committee. I apologize that I don't have that information.
I'm just going to say this for both agencies, and that is that we did ask you to bring specifics. And I will say that it's difficult if people have questions to ask you them when we're giving them the information after the hearing is over.
Understood.
Are there questions?
Yes.
Senator Sharon.
This is a question for you, Senator. I'm trying to get oriented based on what I've heard so far as to what the purpose of today's meeting is and what it is we're trying to
what it was?
Yeah. I just would I'd like that restated because I've become
confused
about this.
The purpose was, you know, in my opinion, a 10% unallotment of staff from the Department of Human Services is a large amount. And I wanted to know where there are vacancies that are going to be left empty, so that when we're working with the Department of Human Services on different things, we would know, you know, where they are thinner than they used to be. And we wanted to know how much of it was one time.
Madam Chair.
Senator Corey.
And Madam Chair, so then really in essence this process is we're trying to gather this information so that we can make the decisions for the next biennium, correct?
Exactly. And I remember a few years ago I was having difficulty with the Department of Human Services. I think it was about the Oregon list. And so I proposed a 16% reduction in the central office, kind of get people's attention. We either save one way or we save another way, and that's true around here. And, oh, my gosh, you would have thought the world was going to come to an end. Well, I think since that time, we're now up to more than 16% in reductions in the central office. So, you know, it'd just be kind of nice to know where we're at with it in terms of our expectations going forward and what we're going to do for the next round. And so that was really the purpose of the meeting. It was not possible from the governor's unallotment letter to figure out. It was just, you know, there'll be 10% unallotment of the department staff. Senator Lurie?
Yeah, Madam Chair, both agencies have now said they'd follow up with more information. I guess I'd like to ask about the timing, when we can expect that, and how we would go about asking more questions after it's come, like you pointed out.
Madam Chair and Senator Lurie, my intention is to go back to the agency and indicate the kind of information that you've asked for and get a response back to the committee as soon as possible, certainly within the next day or so.
Thank you.
So then perhaps there would be someone here that could answer questions next week, Tuesday at our hearing, if there are any.
Yes, Madam Chair, certainly.
Other questions, Senator Sharon?
Well, I was hoping, I did send this over to the department. One of the issues that have been raised in my district and in other districts is about the state law that requires layoffs, if there are layoffs, to be proportional between management, supervisory, and personnel of line support. So I would like an answer to a question, which is, what's the plan to ensure compliance with that law? If necessary, layoffs are occurring to balance the budget. You know, and if, I think that when I ask a question, I'm asking about more than we plan to, just a response that we would plan to be in compliance with the law. I would like to see how we're demonstrating that we are in the course of the last layoffs that have occurred in the systems, both state-operated services and DHS, you know, how we are in the process of dealing with layoffs as we're adjusting our budgets to this deficit, that we are in compliance with that law. And I'm hoping for a very specific answer to whether or not we are in compliance with that so far and how we're going to be in compliance with that law throughout the system.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, may I ask a question to make sure I understand? Because I did receive the email that you sent last evening, so thank you for that. But when I read the email, I honestly had the idea in my head that you were asking about the coming budget, the 10-11 budget. So my first response would be that discussion needs to wait until the governor's budget recommendations are out. But now I understand from what you're saying that you are also interested in information on the items in your email that have to do with the current biennium. Is that correct?
That's correct, because we've had to make adjustments in the current biennium. So I think the plan for the future is important as well. My understanding in having some discussions in an effort to get answers to this question, that at least the departments are interpreting the law to allow this to occur over a two-year period system-wide. So if that's the case, then we need to look back 2 years and then, again, look at the plan for looking forward for 2 years. And I'd like to have an understanding about whether or not we're doing what the law requires us to do.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, I will take your request back. I'm guessing that for those kinds of questions, I wouldn't be able to promise a response quite as promptly as tomorrow or the following day, but we'll get that information to you as quickly as we can.
I'm not sure what that means, Senator Berglund. What from your experience is a time frame that would be reasonable for us to ask for this information?
Well, we are having folks up next on the agenda that might be able to answer your question more directly than Ms. Rankin can.
Madam Chair.
Senator Corrigan.
Madam Chair, would my colleague Senator Sharon answer a question from me?
I'd be willing to try to answer a question. I don't know if I'll know the answer.
Madam Chair, I guess I'm not, and Senator Sharon, I'm not. I don't. Is this a statute? And can you elaborate on that? You're saying when layoffs have to occur that it has to be evenly
spread out between management and lower level staffers. Is that what I'm understanding? I guess I'm not aware of this.
Just as the background, that my understanding that state law requires layoffs to be proportional between management supervisory personnel and line support personnel. It's Minnesota Statutes 43A.046. But it's been interpreted by DOER to allow compliance across an agency over a two-year time period. So that's a agency interpretation about that. So in the course of budget reconciliation issues, from having to spend more than the budget allowed in the state-operated services last year, and now with the reconciliation at the end of the year, there are layoffs occurring throughout the system of line staff, and the line staff are asking us as senators to make certain that this statute is that we are in compliance with this statute. And I think that there might be some reports once the session ends that we'd be able to request, and I can send a specific list of those reports to the department for us to receive certain reports that would help us follow this. But today what I was hoping to ask is, have we been doing this in the last 2 years, and what's our plan to do that as we reconcile these budget difficulties in the future?
Just to clarify one more time. So there's some concern that management is not being cut proportionately. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay.
In management administration.
Senator Lori?
Just one question. I wasn't aware of this statute either and would like to track it and like to find out if it applies more broadly to reductions in staff through attrition as well as just through layoffs, or is it only when we resort to actual layoffs, because a lot of the staffing reduction savings come through just not filling positions and the like. As we look into this, I'd like to find out how broadly this statute applies.
We'll make note of that. Ms. Rankin, I don't know, since we don't have the list of by line item of unallotments, but I received a memo yesterday indicating that while the department has testified that they have discontinued the Health Match project, that there actually are still 11 contractors working on this project, and that their contract has been extended to March of 2010, and that those contractors are being paid an average of $110 an hour. I'd like to get more information about that. I'd like to know what the memo that I received said is true, or whether what has been testified to in front of this committee is true. Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I just wanted to comment about the information that we're not having seen here today. And the broader issue of transparency and budgeting. I appreciated that this was a topic that you were beginning our committee with, because just as, last session we had a discussion about what should be in the budget, when things come out of the budget, both the legislature and the public need to know, first of all, how much flexibility there was in that budget to begin with, and then secondly, I think what the priorities are going to be from the administration's standpoint when it comes to budget reductions. And I think the lack of information we're seeing here today emphasizes the reason why last session we passed a budget reform bill, which was vetoed, and why we've already introduced it again this session, because I think this is just exactly the kind of problem we run into when we don't get specific information about what's in the budget and have the ability to have a transparent discussion about how these reductions or how the budget generally impacts people's lives and the services that we say we're going to provide. So I'm just wondering, wouldn't this information already have been provided in a letter to the governor? And certainly now after the fact, wouldn't we be entitled to have that same information? And why would it be, when we have a specific meeting scheduled to discuss this today, why would we not have that information? Or if there was any confusion about how much detail was requested, I'm sure Senator Berglund's office, you know, would have provided that. So I just think we need to get on the same page. This is going to be a real difficult session, and we need to really work together to be as transparent as we can with information and as cooperative as we can through this process. So I guess that's
– thanks. Well, we know that there was a written document provided to the Department of Finance, because the Department of Finance has to know what warrants should not be issued. And as I understand it, Finance did run that by the governor, because we could not have this meeting until after the governor had seen it.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, yes, our agency provided a listing to the Department of Finance on January 2nd, and I checked with them last week and was told that although it had not yet been through their approval process, that DHS could assume that it was approved, that nothing at their initial review had been flagged as a concern for them. So at that point, I was able to respond to the invitation to come here today to say that, yes, we could talk about it because the plan was essentially approved. And I apologize for not understanding the level of information that you expected me to be able to bring forth today. And I will get the information that you've asked into your hands as quickly as I can.
Thank you. We appreciate that. Any other questions?
Madam Chair, I just thought of one other thing. I did have a constituent ask me, because I think a lot of my constituents are worried about the budget, and they asked if there's any way, and I don't know who this question is directed to, maybe to you, Madam Chair, is there any way that the average citizen can go online and actually see the budget on a line-per-line basis? Is there any place for that?
Well, once a governor's budget is proposed, that will be posted online, and that would be the proposed budget. It would not be – it would be a change item budget. I mean, you saw when we went through 2 years ago sort of a base budget review.
Yes.
Our book was about that thick.
Right.
So that's not online as far as I know. But the governor's change recommendations will be online. Our recommendations won't be online because we will be in the process of reviewing the governor's budget and making our budget. But once our budget has been introduced into the Senate, then it will be online also.
Can I ask another question? The governor did say that there was talk of a zero-based budgeting. And I don't know if you can answer this or not. Is that the way that you're putting the budget together, is just starting at zero and working your way up? Or probably an odd question.
Madam Chair and Senator Coring, the budget that the governor will be issuing in a week or so, I would not expect to see a zero-based budget when he makes his announcement.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know if you know what I mean by zero-based budgeting. It means that instead of, you know, starting at $9 billion or whatever it would be and building on, you actually start from the bottom and start to put all of it together. Is that zero? That's zero-based.
His budget will be a change page budget. So he'll be starting where we're at and subtracting, and we'll see the pages where the subtractions are occurring.
Okay.
You know, I have thought about whether we wanted to do a base budget review again, but it is very time consuming, and I don't know if we would have enough time to do that, considering what else we have ahead of us. But you can give me your feedback about that if there's there's a desire for it, we'll try to see if we can do it.
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, in some of the other committees that were added, and to respond to the chair's question about a review, that review was very helpful for us new members coming in, but it did take a long time, and that was just a review of the current budget. And what you're talking about, Senator Coring, if I understand, is starting at zero and building a brand new frame. And in other committees that I've been in, there has been discussion about that. But just the review takes so long of the current budget. It's my understanding it would be at least a 12-month or 18-month exercise at a time when you're not in crisis to start at zero, analyze all the programs, and do a zero-based budget exercise. And right now we are in the midst of a crisis, so we need to deal very quickly and swiftly with the projected deficit. It may be a really good thing for the legislature at some point to look at doing a zero-based budgeting exercise so we can establish our priorities and talk with the state and citizens about what our state's priorities should be. But it seems that it's impractical at this point.
And, Madam Chair, if I could just comment, I agree with you wholeheartedly, and I think that in the future, to me, in my short 6 years here, not pointing a finger at anybody, but it seems like we don't look very far ahead. We look maybe ahead to the next 2 years. We don't look ahead 10, 20 years. And I think I'm a supporter that I think when we pass any law, and I mean any law, there should be a sunset date on it, and we should come back and review that to see if it's working. All these books in my office with all these laws, it's just more and more and more and more. And every time, and nothing against the new members, but every time we get new members, they have to spread their wings a little bit and introduce some laws, and then we have more laws. And I don't know that that's always a good thing. I'm trying to curtail the introductions of any laws from myself, because I think people have got enough laws on the books. But I just think that it's not working the way we're doing it, and I think we need to review everything. Not saying that the legislature should meet year-round. I don't think that's a good idea, because I don't think the public is safe when we're meeting. But so anyway, enough said.
Well, and Senator Coring, if I can just throw something in for you to think about. In my opinion, oftentimes it's not a matter of eliminating a budget item. It's a matter of restructuring a program to try to make it operate more efficiently and to try to save money within that line item, not eliminate the line item. So when you're doing base budget, zero-based budgeting, you're not really focusing as much on that. And that's kind of what I think we need to be focusing on right now. And so if people get ideas about that, please. There are not too many ideas that can be found. So so that's kind of where I'm coming from right now.
Thanks, Senator.
Other questions for Ms. Rankin?
Well, this question can be answered by Ms. Rankin or whomever might be able to help me. Thank you, Senator Berglund. I want to sort of go back to what we were talking about earlier about that we establish a budget, and then if revenues do not meet the forecasted expectation, there's modifications to how the departments are spending those dollars, or there's a request by the governor to reduce expenditures by 10%. It's unclear to me yet whether or not, although we are required as a legislature to define by law how revenues are expended, I'm not certain what is a regulatory, or if we need another regulation, Senator Coring. I'm hoping not. To be specific, to require that the legislature gets to see very specifically how changes are made in terms of spending once we've passed a law authorizing certain expenditures. What is in statute now that guides the department of these departments to come back to the legislature, or obligates them to come back and explain very specifically how they've changed what we assume are happening because we've written it into law based on assumptions about revenue? What's there that?
Well, Senator Sharon, we do appropriate based on line items. We don't just give the Department of Human Services a block grant. I mean, sometimes they act that way a little bit, but it's really not true. We appropriate based on line items. And
but does the law itself, when there's an allotment, whether it's in a line item or not, require the department to come back and and make transparent what those changes are to us as a legislature and therefore to the public? Is that in the law?
The law doesn't require it, but we have requested it. And obviously, you know, as a finance division, we have a right to do that. And I would think any other finance division would be requesting it also.
It just seems today like we're having trouble getting it, though. we request it.
Senator Sharon, you know, operating government by unallotment is unusual. It's not the norm. Okay, Ms. Rankin, thank you very much. For both departments, I'll withhold my judgment until I actually get the unallotment list. But if either department happened to have 10% of money of their central office budget laying around, I would be shocked. The next item on the agenda is an update on MITO. You will remember we had a hearing on this during the interim because of issues that came to light as a result of the ombudsman's investigation of complaints that she'd been receiving regarding the MITO program. And so we're going to do a review now of changes that might have been made to address those concerns. We have with us today Mike Tesmer, who is well known to us. We also have Reed Sulik, who is new and welcome to our committee. He is the new Assistant Commissioner of Chemical and Mental Health at DHS.
Good morning. Madam Chair and members of the committee, as Madam Chair indicated, I'm Dr. Reed Sulik. Background is I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist as well as an adult psychiatrist and also a pediatrician, the newly appointed Assistant Commissioner for Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration within the Department of Human Services. This morning, we're going to take this opportunity to walk you through essentially who we are within state-operated services, who we serve, and our vision of how to best serve them. And we're going to do that as part of our update to you on MITO. What I've asked Mr. Tesmer to do is to begin this morning with giving us just a quick synopsis of the history that has of the concerns that were raised within the last, I believe, 2 years at the MITO facility. And the MITO facility is the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options Facility. And then after a brief synopsis, what I would like to do is give you the big picture view of how MITO fits into the vision of state-operated services and the transformational changes that are currently underway, not only within MITO, but within the entire state-operated service system. So, Mr. Tesmer.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, some of this will be new to you, and some of it will be a kind of a review. The Ombudsman's Office came in to the program about a year and a half ago and started looking at a couple of situations that had been brought to their attention. They also worked with the Office of Health Facility Complaints, Minnesota Department of Health, around the concerns that they raised. Those concerns resulted in a number of citations around a lack of positive interventions in the program and an over-reliance on the use of restraints. The program engaged with those deficiencies and successfully modified their policies and procedures and their utilization of positive supports, as well as a decreased reliance on the use of restraints, and successfully resolved those citations. This past summer, MITO program invited a group of national experts in with expertise specifically looking at the population that MITO is serving and came up with a series of recommendations that were not dissimilar from those issues raised by both the Ombudsman and the Department of Health. They also not only raised the issues, but they gave us some ideas on directions to take to avoid the problem in the future. And with that, I'll turn it back to Dr. Sewell.
Thank you. What I'd like to do is give you the big picture view of what I've been bringing into the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration since I have started, and how this fits in also with the goals for MEDO. I have 7 goals of excellence that I have provided to all my staff across the entire Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration, and I will walk you through how our aspirations to achieve these goals across the system fit specifically back to MEDO as well. But just to quickly summarize, when it comes to mental health and addictions, not only here in Minnesota but across this country, I think that there are 7 specific goals that any of us in the system recognize that we need to continue to move forward towards achieving. The first being to eradicate the stigma of mental illness and addictions, overcoming the misconceptions, misunderstandings, and misperceptions that individuals have of individuals with a mental illness and an addiction. We need to improve access to the right care at the right time, not relying on somebody decompensating to the point of crisis and requiring inpatient services. You'll hear me talk about that further. We need to establish quality standards of care and standards of practice so that there is a clear approach to the application of standards, not only across different regions in the state, but across providers of all areas of medicine. I think this is, in my field, is the area in which we need to achieve this greater than in any other. I think if we look at models of standardization of care and we look at the positive outcomes from those models, we can see the impact of arriving at protocols and arriving at standards can have. I'd invite you to just quickly look at the childhood leukemia data, for instance, from 1960 to the year 2000. In the 1960, the child mortality rate, the 5-year mortality rate from childhood onset leukemia was approximately 95%. In the year 2000, the 5-year mortality rate was almost zero. And if you really look at the advancement in the medicines that occurred in that 40-year period, it parallels quite similarly the tremendous advancements in mental health and in the medications, in particular in mental health, that we've had during that same period of time. We have nowhere near those type of outcomes in my field. And what really accounts for the tremendous change in outcomes is the standards of care that were established by the child, the pediatric oncologist in that specialty. And I'd like to apply that same mission to our area as well. Our fourth goal is to integrate care and across services. And our fifth goal is to reduce the cost and improve the efficiency. And as Madam Chair had indicated earlier, we are recognizing the need to dramatically look at how we can not just reduce care, but improve care at reduced cost. And I think that you will see that I have some specific applications that will get us to that point. As mental health experts, we don't spend enough time promoting wellness and preventing mental illness. And I see that there's very easy ways to capitalize on the tremendous amount of talent that is in our system to be able to do that. And finally, the final 7th goal that applies to all the areas within state operated services is our goal to reduce the consequences of severe illness. I'll point out that individuals with a mental illness, adults with a mental illness, die approximately 25 years prematurely compared to their cohorts. Because of the chronic conditions and medical complications associated with their illness as well. To me, this is unacceptable and requires a tremendous amount of attention. I also point out that we rank 12th in the country as having the highest childhood suicide rate in the country, which I also find unacceptable. And so by no means are we accomplishing these goals yet, but you will hear me, as long as I'm sitting in this role, continuously bring up how our goals within our services, how we need to be mindful of these specific goals. Quickly, I just want to introduce you to our administration. The Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration of the Minnesota Department of Human Services has 3 policy divisions: the Adult Mental Health Policy Division, the Children's Mental Health Policy Division, the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division, which used to be called the Chemical Health Division, and then also all of state-operated services.
Commissioner, there was a question Senator Pretner-Solon had. If we can.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, a comment. Dr. Sulik, I really want to commend you on your goals of excellence. And I think that one of the areas that inhibits quality care, actually it affects all 7 areas, is that people with mental health have a hard time accessing other areas of health also because of the stigma that's involved. And so that affects the quality standards. It affects the cost of their care. It affects their wellness and their the length of their life, their mortality. So I commend you on these goals of excellence.
Thank you. Madam Chair, if I could make one backup comment. If the fourth goal of integrating care, I really firmly believe accomplishes, helps us accomplish all of these goals. If you ask my personal opinion, the separation of mental health from the rest of healthcare has been an experiment that has failed miserably in this country. And I have been moving for the last 9 years, not only here in Minnesota, but at the national level, to really move to integrate mental health care and the rest of healthcare, and particularly primary health care. And you will continuously hear me speak to that, the importance of that that aspect. So thank you very much.
Well, it's a good time for you to be joining state government then, because it's one of the projects that we're working on.
Excellent. Thank you. Quickly, if you look at the snapshot view of the array of services that are provided in state-operated services, it is an enormously complicated system. If you don't think about how all these systems fit together and really fully understand the charge that we have to provide care for the most complex affected within the state of Minnesota, it's hard to really see how all these fit together. There are over 4,200 staff employed by state-operated services. There's over 14,000 clients served directly each year. And our total budget within state-operated services is $316 million. The state appropriation component of that budget is $181 million currently, and I will explain the differences between those two numbers for you. But if you look at the left-hand part of this slide, you can see that there is an array of services that range from intensive inpatient services to residential services to child and adolescent services, our neurorehabilitation program, which is for the which is a program for traumatic brain injured individuals, as well as the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options Program, which is an intensive program that I just want to introduce here so that you understand really the charge of MITA, which is to provide intensive treatment services for individuals who have a developmental disability and a psychiatric illness and a significant behavioral dysregulation problem as a result of the combination of their psychiatric illness and their developmental disability. It's really important to understand the level of complexity of the individuals that are there and therefore the level of sophistication that we really need to be bringing into facilities providing this level of care.
Chair, can I ask a question on that slide?
Sure. Senator Coring.
Dr. Sulik. So the 4,200 people, that's statewide, that's group homes, it's all the list that you have on here, correct?
Madam Chair, correct.
Okay.
But these are services that we don't contract for. These are services we provide directly.
These are, Madam Chair, these are direct services that State Operated Services provides, correct?
And Commissioner, one other question might be under the general title of MITO, Minnesota Extended Treatment Options, on the list, but I was under the impression that shortly after the federal government let us know that they were no longer going to help us pay for the MITO program, that we developed a cadre of people who could go out to facilities in the state to provide short-term assistance with behaviors of clients to try to reduce the number of people that needed to be in the MITO program itself, the Cambridge site. And is that still happening, and to what extent is that happening as a part of the MITO program?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, what you are referring to is actually community support services within state-operated services. What I can speak to prior to my arrival within state government as a child and adolescent psychiatrist in central Minnesota, I have utilized those services for a number of my patients over the years. And so I think that there's not only are those community support services serving clients directly involved with state-operated services, but also helping individuals remain within their community and not requiring state-operated service programming by providing some intensive behavioral analysis and behavioral supports within their homes and within their schools for the child and adolescent population in particular. So there is a large group of community support services, and I will tell you that my assessment of all the services within state-operated services, this is the area that I believe is truly one of our shining stars, because I think that it does have some tremendous outcomes associated with it.
Well, and they also provide services to group homes and to waivered service programs. So how many people are there that are doing that component, do you know?
Mr. Tesner, I don't know if you have a better, quicker view of that, that you can answer that.
It's not broken down. Madam Chair, I believe the number is somewhere close to 40 staff that are posted statewide. So there's essentially teams in each region of the state that are accessible to those regions. But I believe the number is around 40.
I guess the feedback that I received recently is that there maybe aren't enough. Or maybe at times, maybe the workload isn't as even as it maybe we wish it would be.
Madam Chair, and we'll get to this in a couple minutes, in looking at the MITO program and what the services are that the folks that are going there now really need, we are looking at community support services and its role, and do we need to shift resources from the intensive residential side into more of the community-based. So that's one of the things we're looking at.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Let's continue then.
Snapshot view of the state of Minnesota. You have this in your packet as well. It's difficult to see all the details indicated in this map of the state, but it's here to portray to you the array of services and how they cluster across the entire state. Obviously, there are areas where we don't have direct, we don't have facilities in specific areas, but the idea is that there is and will continue to be even an improved representation of services across the regions in Minnesota. If you look at the total number of facilities itself, it totals well over 200. There are 114 residential facilities. These do include group homes. There are 30 Minnesota intensive therapeutic homes. I will tell you that those are another area that I consider essentially a shining star in the model that's there. These are very structured, intensive therapeutic foster care homes, part of the overall network of the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services, and really do allow us to have individuals transition out of intensive inpatient services into a therapeutic community support program. There are 19 day training and habilitation programs, 16 adult mental health programs total. That includes the 10 community behavioral health hospitals. There are 6 addiction recovery programs. Those are noted as CARE programs, the Community Addiction Recovery Enterprise programs. These are intensive inpatient or residential chemical dependency treatment programmings. And again, there's the neurorehabilitative services in Brainerd, the Minnesota Security Hospital, the Minnesota Extended Treatment Option in Cambridge. This is a diagram just to help you understand how I think and how I'm asking my administration to think about who we are and who we serve. Essentially, we need to think about the spectrum of care. And in the entire spectrum of care, know that most mental health services are provided in the state of Minnesota within primary care settings. If you look specifically at psychotropic medications prescribed in the state of Minnesota, 80% are prescribed by primary care physicians. I've been working for almost a decade in trying to get our community mental health providers to be integrated with primary care providers in a much more sophisticated and helpful manner. That theme, you will hear, is also being applied here, that our role in the state specialty care system is to provide care for the most severely affected and the most complex individuals in this entire spectrum of care,
we essentially need to be seeing ourselves as the intensivists. And our role is not only to provide care for those individuals who are at that end of the spectrum, but to provide that care in a way that allows them to transition out of inpatient programming into much more appropriate levels of care in the timeliest manner possible, allow us to stabilize them with intensive therapeutic interventions as effectively as possible, and integrate them back into their community mental health care provider system as well as their primary care provider system. Part of our role then really needs to be providing ongoing consultation and collaboration with our community mental health care providers and our primary care providers as well. So defining that our role in the state specialty care system is to think about this end of the spectrum, but not think of this end of the spectrum in a silo. Okay, the next slide demonstrates to you a sort of restructuring philosophically about state-operated services and thinking of it as a healthcare system. Having come from a healthcare system and been in this world of healthcare, I can tell you that we think about centers of care or care centers. And rather than service lines, rather than product lines, these are centers of care. We have a child and adolescent behavioral health center of care. We have an adult mental health center of care. We have a community addiction and a recovery center of care, a forensic center of care, a neurorehabilitative and neurodevelopmental disorder center of care, and we do have a dental center of care as well. There are 5 dental clinics within state-operated services that have been here historically. Part of our role is to provide dental care for those individuals that are so isolated from the rest of the healthcare system, there's no way that they could get access to dental care without us providing care for them. What I want to also introduce is that we are creating a governance board that will be essentially a governance council made up of professionals and community members providing ongoing oversight of the entire state-operated services, modeling, again, also the type of board structure that we have in healthcare systems. I'm visioning an overall governance board as well as a governance board over each of the centers of care. The specific centers of care boards will be made up of a large number of consumers, giving us the voices of the consumers and that representation across the system. What is indicated in red are those programs that are currently not appropriated by the state but that are in an enterprise structure, and what is indicated in blue are those programs that are appropriated by the state.
I've got a question, Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
This governance, Dr. Sulik, this governance board, is this something new that the department's looking at doing? And when you say oversight, is it oversight as far as just suggestions, or they wouldn't have any, like we have oversight, but would they have, they wouldn't have certainly the oversight that we have.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Coring. Caring?
Coring.
Coring.
I'm very caring,
I'm sorry.
But it's Coring.
But it's Coring. Thank you. Caring and Coring fits. The answer to that would be that there is currently a governance council or governance board. It's not quite as active as I would like to see. The word oversight really is more of a consultation advisory board, and that's it's very important to clarify that for you. So this would not be legal oversight. It would not be direction, but it would be essentially creating an opportunity to have professional community members of the community, and consumers very actively involved in the ongoing visioning of the services.
Kind of putting it, Madam Chair, kind of putting everybody's heads together to try to figure out if we're heading in the right direction.
Correct.
In essence. Okay, I understand.
Correct. I'd like to point out, I just want to show off a little PowerPoint skills, but on the NeuroHat, this new care center, what I will say is that MITO has traditionally been structured under the forensics system, and I really envision that the MITO program and our neurorehabilitative program have a lot of parallels, and I see those services structured together. I think not identifying the MITO program within forensics helps to overcome all kinds of misperceptions about the type of care that is provided and needs to be provided there. This is the vision of the array of services at that more complex end of the spectrum that we need to be thinking about. Currently, we are heavily weighted on providing intensive inpatient services, but we don't have enough of the step-down specialized residential, intensive residential, partial hospitalization services in order to best meet the needs of our patients. Those services, as you go up this diagram, are all significantly less expensive, and I would say from a therapeutic standpoint, honestly more effective. Our outcomes from partial hospitalization programming are tremendously better than from inpatient programming because typically the role of inpatients should be to stabilize patients in order to be allow them to come out of a locked, secured inpatient setting into a much more appropriate level of care. So this is the vision of trying to see how we can apply this cluster of services and how they can fit in a seamless manner across each of those centers of care. The slide's a little complicated, and I just want to walk you through the right-hand side of the slide. There's a way of looking at patients in an inpatient setting and assessing them to determine how well do they really meet criteria for inpatient services. That's called the LOCUS. It's the Level of Care Utilization Service Tool. What the LOCUS does is it measures multiple domains based on symptom severity, complexity of the patient, environmental supports, and comorbidity of other disorders, and tells us, does this patient fit inpatient criteria? LOCUS 6 is the highest category of service and corresponds with somebody who would require inpatient care. We recently did a snapshot view of, I'm going to just plot forward for a minute to this slide. We recently did a snapshot view of the individuals in our inpatient settings. This is not specific to MEDO. This is looking at patients in the inpatient units at Anoka and our community behavioral health hospitals. What you can see is of the total number of patients, most of the patients in the hospital did not meet criteria any longer for being in the hospital. But they're there because they don't have the services to be able to discharge them into. And so this vision of having much better array of services at this end of the spectrum and also challenging our community mental health providers to step up to the plate and also be participating in the creation of some of these non-inpatient services is really critical. Level 5 is a level of service that would fit with a specialized residential or even a partial hospitalization. And you can see where most of our patients in our current inpatient settings actually fit criteria for a level 5. They could be served in an intensive residential or outpatient setting and don't require this long-term inpatient length of stay that has been there. We don't have a tool specific to the developmentally disabled population, so I don't have something this sophisticated to share with you about the patients at the MEDO facility specifically, but I can tell you in my discussions with MEDO and other patients there, our role is twofold. One is to assess patients coming into that program to make sure that they meet the level of criteria for that program, and we don't have patients there that are at an acuity level far greater than what MEDO can handle. I can tell you that that's been my assessment of what's happened historically there that got us into difficulty there, because there are patients at a much higher level of acuity that should have been able to be transitioned into an inpatient setting and then stabilized and then transferred back into MEDO. And we've already worked out the dynamics of that system so that that can occur much more seamlessly now. I think that we also need something to step patients down into out of MEDO so that we don't have patients at MEDO for 2 or 3 years length of stay or even longer.
Madam Chair, if I could just ask a question.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, what was the LOCUS? What is the, I have to relearn all these acronyms. Is this a new acronym that we have to learn, or what does it stand for again? You know you said it, but I didn't catch it.
Madam Chair and Senator, this is the LOCUS stands for the first of all, don't try to learn the acronym. There's too many of these to learn in state government. Rely on me to explain it to you.
Okay.
It's the level of care.
Level.
And that's really what you need to know about it, that this is a tool that allows us to assess what's the most appropriate level of care for this individual based on their complexity.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Reed, MEDO, is that LOCUS 5?
MEDO would be a LOCUS 5, correct.
Okay.
If you look at this, I'll point out one of the
Senator Berglund, before you go forward, yeah. May I also ask a question?
Senator Sharon.
It's holding me back in terms of moving forward with you. In an earlier time, you were talking about enterprise supported and appropriation supported. Would you help me understand, because child and adolescent behavioral care, community addiction recovery, does that mean that it's what is the differences in terms of funding sources for this? What does that mean?
Madam Chair, Senator, and other members of the committee, if you go back to this diagram, which is what you're talking about, what is red, when I mentioned enterprise, that means that currently those programs are existing without state appropriations and are relying on billing in order to sustain services. You'll hear from me in the future that that has not been working that well.
If I can just interrupt you for a minute.
Yes.
They do not receive a direct appropriation.
Correct.
But when they are billing, most of the time, or many times, they're billing Medicaid, which is a state-appropriated program. It's just not directly appropriated to this service provider. So they're operating like other service providers in the community who are private, who also bill Medicaid and live off of their earnings. So an enterprise service is earning revenue, and it is expected to live off of its earnings.
Thank you.
I'd like to move specifically to an update on MEDO. When I arrived in November, one of the first things I did was briefed on the concerns that had been raised about the MEDO facility over the last 2 years. I met with several of the staff at MEDO, had an opportunity to tour the facility, been up there on at least three different occasions to meet with staff, advocacy groups. I've met with the ombudsman. I've reviewed the reports. I've had an opportunity to look historically back at some of the events that had occurred and the concerns about the use of restraints, the frequency of restraints used, the type of restraints used. What I can say is this, that first of all, know that my background is such that I opened the first, probably the first, locked, secured inpatient adolescent mental health unit in the country that did not use seclusion or mechanical restraints. That was at St. Cloud Hospital, which I opened that unit. It was a 12-bed adolescent unit in 1999 when I arrived there. So philosophically, my belief is we can do this. And I've got a track record that can demonstrate that we can significantly reduce restraints and seclusion. And we don't necessarily always need to be using them. It requires an intensive amount of training and ongoing support and philosophical changes, I think, in the mental health field that has been emerging, not only just in central Minnesota where I've been, but really all over the country, really looking at ways that we can not only reduce but even eliminate the use of restraints as needed. One of the arguments of that I was confronted with initially when I opened up the unit in St. Cloud was that we would have a dramatic increase of chemical restraints if we didn't use seclusion and mechanical restraints, and the exact opposite was true. We wound up taking automatic orders for chemical restraints off our admission order sheet. Once our staff had been really skilled and developed the skill set needed to be intervening and teaching some self-soothing and self-calming skills to our patients, which is really one of our goals. Our patients at MEDO are there because they're complex, and they're there because they're dysregulated, and they don't have the automatic abilities to regulate some of their behavioral impulses, and it's gotten them in a lot of trouble. So part of our interventions there have got to be a reframing and rethinking these individuals, and also a training, an intensive training, not only of the staff, but of the patients there in self-regulation. And that is one of the therapeutic goals there. I think historically what has happened is that there are patients that were at MEDO that should not have been at MEDO at that level of acuity. They should have been in an inpatient setting, intensively stabilized psychiatrically because of the complexity of their psychiatric illness, and then transferred back to MEDO. I think that was a flaw in the system, and how even in one system, there are silo walls that keep people from being able to migrate into appropriate levels of care, even within the same system. This is not unique to state-operated services. Historically, I've found this everywhere. I think that we've been able to analyze how that happened, and I think what I'm here to assure you is that I think we have a very clear plan of how to make certain that that never happens again.
Senator? Thank you, Madam Chair. Admittedly, this isn't my area of expertise, but I have to ask, when you are indicating that we have discontinued the use of these mechanical restraints as recently as September of 2008, I think that's surprising to me, frankly. And I wonder if you would care to comment on that. It's almost as if this was a new revelation. Is this a new revelation?
No, let me clarify, Madam Chair and Senator, let me clarify that specific comment on this slide. If you look forward one slide to the next slide, this is the data of mechanical restraints used at MITO. Now, the term mechanical restraints, how MITO got themselves in trouble is they were using handcuffs. They were using metal restraints, which they've discontinued completely after this was brought to attention and after people examined that. Even if that was an effective way of intervening to provide safety, it was not fitting with a therapeutic environment, and that was eliminated. There are two different types of restraints that were used historically, restraint procedures used at MITO historically. Emergency restraints, when somebody escalates to the point where they are clearly in an agitated state and a risk of harm to themselves and others around them, then intervening to obtain control of the patient is necessary. That's an emergency restraint procedure. A program restraint would be, can we, and again, know that this is just a historical piece, that there were programmatic restraints used. So it was developed in, written into a patient's treatment plan, was the use of restraints if X, Y, or Z behaviors were present as a way to keep the patient from exhibiting behaviors X, Y, and Z. The use of programmatic restraints has been eliminated at MITO as of September of this year. So there is not a patient with a treatment plan that has the programmatic use of restraints in it. Restraints are used if patients are escalating to the point of agitation where they are requiring restraint. Now, I want to assure you the type of monitoring that is currently going on and my view of the data thus far. And I'm not surprised by this finding. The use of, as the use of programmatic restraints has stopped, and that's been, that occurred prior to my arrival in November, the use of emergency restraints, the frequency of restraints used for an emergency purpose, guess what? Went up. I'm not surprised by that. However, it's not the outcome we want. It goes up because staff and patients still aren't at a point of comfort and level of skill set in the regulation skills necessary to be able to implement the types of interventions needed in order to avoid restraint use completely. So we know that this will take some time, but I think I feel very confident that the right things are in place to get us there. So the fact that if I look at the data, it's hard to see that on this slide, but when I've looked specifically at the data of emergency restraint uses, the frequency of emergency restraint use over the last year actually went up in the last couple months compared to the prior to the last couple months as the programmatic use of restraints declined. Again, I'm not surprised by that. It's not the outcome I want to see, but I think we know exactly what to do in order to keep providing the support to the staff on two things: training and their skill set needed, but also the assessment of the patients there in a much more sophisticated manner so that we can transfer patients into a higher level of care if needed. If patients are needing emergency restraint procedures at MITO, that says to me they're at a higher level of care need and may need stabilization at Anoka, for instance, and then transfer back into MITO. One of the things that they found, two things with the patients there because of the complexity, very often patients are coming in either with very inadequate psychiatric assessments previously and with a very inadequate medication regimen to help them, or the opposite is true, where patients are coming in on a far too cumbersome and complicated regimen of medications because they've not been in a setting to help provide the structure and support for their behaviors. So there are some patients that have medications increased while they're there, and there's quite a number of patients whose the medication regimen is actually decreased and really simplified while they're there. So I think that the therapeutic goals at Medo are know that I'm confident that they're in line with my philosophies and with the philosophies of where we're taking the administration. My goal is to see emergency interventions of restraints decreased now even more significantly than the total number we've seen thus far.
Senator Lori.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Zulek. As I was looking at the Ombudsman's report, reviewing it, one of the things that seemed to come out at me was not so much a lack of good rules from the agency, but a lack of oversight and not coming to actually ensure that existing rules were being implemented properly. And I'm seeing more rules, but have you addressed the oversight? I mean, have you been out to the facilities that were implementing these restraints and been overseeing the implementation of these new rules? I mean, I think these rules are good, but it seemed to me that there was a great deal of lack of oversight as well of existing rules that could have been much better enforced and avoided a lot of the issues that we got into.
Certainly, Madam Chair and Senator and members of the committee. Let me introduce you to a couple things that I've done differently since I arrived in November. Been up to Medo several times now, and I've made some changes in direct reporting to me. Historically, there has never been a clinical director reporting to the assistant commissioner from state-operated services. Recently, we've had not just Mr. Tesner, but also the chief financial officer reporting to the assistant commissioner. And I have reassigned also the clinical directors of each of these areas of care as direct reports to me. So now the medical director for forensics and the neurorehabilitative program and the clinical director, who's a psychologist, both directly report to me, which is my philosophy of how to run a healthcare system. I want not only the administrative report, I want the financial report and also the clinical report, and that's a way of assuring that I am being updated continuously about the clinical needs and the clinical operations of the facilities across the whole administration. I think the additional oversight piece, and this is really philosophically where I was getting with the discussion of the governance boards, to have consumer representation on a board that is continuously meeting and reviewing this is who we are, who we serve, and how we serve them, allows us to provide a check and balance system that I think works pretty effectively. And I think that'll continue to provide us some philosophical oversight and advice and counsel as we continue to transform the programs across the system. I think that we also have a new clinical director at Medo. This is not because the previous clinical director was found to be in fault. That individual went on and took a different position. It was a nice sort of rise up in a role for him. With a new clinical director at the Medo facility, again, it's an opportunity to really shape philosophy from the very beginning. And I'm really quite excited, honestly, about the directional change that we're going to see in that particular organization.
Senator Sharon?
I have a few questions, if you'll indulge me. Thank you. It's very nice to meet you. I hope to spend some time with you.
Great.
More than today. But just in relationship to Senator Lori's comment, earlier I thought about your seven goals, and I wondered if under quality of care you were addressing this issue or if it should be an eighth responsibility, which is protection or oversight of the consumer. So just as a thought to you. Great. To think about that.
Certainly.
And I heard you saying that by this recent change in policy where programmatically restraints are not utilized, that that's a change in policy. What you're saying is that you decrease using restraint as a threat or a behavioral threat to discourage a certain behavior as a treatment modality. But what's missing is the development of the skill set in both the patients and in the staff to create alternative ways of dealing with agitation or anxiety or aggression, and that you're going to target that skill set. So we should anticipate an upgrade in restraint that's crisis-related until that's built in the client or certainly is built in the staff. When we heard the report or initial report about MITO, the report from the department indicated that the staff was a fully qualified staff. And I think that's probably true, but what I'm hearing from you is that you've done some analysis of what might have contributed to this problem, and developing this skill set in the staff would have identified that as maybe one of the root causes of the problem, or that we were also admitting to MITO a level of acuity that was higher than the facility was able to manage. So when I'm listening to that, I'm listening to you talk about an analysis of the situation that helps you identify what your interventions ought to be. And I applaud you for that. And I think that data like this, if read earlier, ought to stimulate that kind of analysis process. Why are our restraints going up, et cetera, et cetera? And that as you develop those measures that are reported, that process of, I hate to use root cause analysis anymore, it's starting to be lingo, you know, and jargon, but it is an important concept that has to move down from you to the units, to the line staff, that everybody in the system is thinking about following these benchmarks, recognizing changes, and doing an analysis and an intervention so that we don't get spending several months, even years, engaged in a trend without having done this kind of system analysis and intervention. So it's not only our interventions with our clients, those that we serve, but an intervention with our systems that needs to be developed, I think, in our mental health system.
I think to put it more succinctly, we were shocked when we had the hearing during the interim to find out how long this had been going on. Right. And nobody seemed to be doing anything to change it.
Madam Chair and Senator.
That was a question.
Yes. It was a paragraph of questions. But I'm gonna tease apart a couple points to highlight. I think, first of all, and thank you for your comments, because I truly appreciate them. And I think that I don't want to indicate that the skill sets are missing, but they're not at the level of competence and acquisition that I aspire to get to within all of our programs. And I think that know that that's a developmental process and is underway and will continue to be underway. I want to emphasize one thing that I haven't said so far. My heart and soul is in caring for all of these patients and always has been. I was 19 years old and an undergraduate in college and working at group homes with children and adolescents with developmental disabilities and mental illness. I know this population very well. I am probably the hardest individual when it comes to expectations of care on anybody. What I have found when I've gone to MITO is the staff are really good people with the heart and soul in the right place, but needing some additional training and some additional support to get to the level of sophistication where I and all of you want them to be. And we'll get there. The second thing is I think that the point of the assessing the acuity is a different philosophy than has existed currently to be able to move patients within our entire system and move them seamlessly and effectively and providing ongoing assessment. This doesn't happen throughout all of healthcare enough, but particularly in mental health care. And I think that we are set up really quite beautifully to outline a model of care within our state-operated service system that really will show to be a national model of care. I will assure you that I've combed 50 states as I've taken this position and looked for who's doing it best, who's got the system that works most effectively, who's figured these things out, and I have not found anyone. I have not found a state that really meets my expectations of where I want us to get to. And so we don't have a state to compare ourselves to about trying to strive to, but we know what we need to do. It's pretty clear, common sense type of interventions and restructuring and use of data and the use of monitoring ongoing to make sure that our outcomes are matching our goals.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Sulik, for your presentation. I mean, just listening to you, it just sounds like our state is really fortunate to have you in the position you are, and we appreciate your expertise and commitment. The question I have is with regard to interventions or how patients are being managed, is it strictly a matter of the people who are working there having the training and the skills they need, or is there any relationship also to staffing levels, to patient to staffing ratios? And if that's true, are they adequate, and do you see that they'll be adequate going forward, especially with financial, you know, budget pressures? And also, are the salaries adequate to attract and keep people, you know, skilled people in what can sometimes be a difficult environment? And are we going to be able to maintain those salaries with the budget issues we're going to have going forward, or the, whatever the level of salary that's going to be necessary to keep those skilled people working in these different types of treatment modalities?
Madam Chair and Senator, what I'd like to do is I'll start to answer that question. I'm going to ask Mr. Tesner to actually add some additional comments. When it comes to the staffing patterns, across state-operated services, we have not had a flexibility in the staffing patterns according to the patient census in these facilities. I'm hoping to change that as we go into new negotiations with the labor unions, because there's not a healthcare system in the state or in the country that can operate without flexing staff patterns according to patient census. So that's an area of reform I hope to accomplish. Working in healthcare systems, nurses, all direct care staff are accustomed to the expectation that their staffing, their schedule is going to flex according to the need of the facility. And I think we need to just examine that, because there's some significant potential cost savings there that should not force us to look at alternatives regarding laying off a staff regarding in this particular facility. I think pay schedule, we're in a public healthcare system. We pay less than in the private sector, and we need to consciously be looking at, when it comes to good quality direct care staff and professional staff, how do we recruit appropriately and how do we retain appropriately? How do we create an exciting work environment, an environment of excellence, and how do we operate as a center of excellence so people want to be there and they want to provide the care and they want to be part of that facility and this organization? That's what we're trying to get to. And I think we're hopeful that we can, and so that we can help manage through some of these very difficult times that we have in front of us, to keep our staff engaged and excited about where they're working and who they're serving. I'm going to ask you to also make some specific comments about the MEDO staff in this facility in particular that were asked.
The flexibility issue is really huge. We're looking, historically, we've looked at the numbers of people in the program, and we staffed as if it's always full. We're now looking at not just when the census goes up and down, but also the acuity level of the people in the program. And we'll be meeting with labor, because we need to, and working out hopefully a more flexible way to manage both in terms of the numbers of people that we serve, but also the acuity level. In terms of the compensation rates, as Dr. Suluk says, you know, we're in a public sector, so we're not at the forefront of compensation and benefits. And however, we also know that what brings people to work is more than just salary and benefits. It's working in something they love to do. It's working in being recognized and noticed professionally. So we're looking at that as a way to attract and retain individuals, and we've had some success along those lines. When it comes to compensation, and in particularly the expert practitioners that we need to hire, we have been able to work with DOOR, now the Minnesota Management and Budget Office, to look at individual compensation rates when we can't really compete in the marketplace. Now, given where we are in terms of the finances for the state and in healthcare and in the nation's economy, that's going to be a tough road to hoe now. But we've been successful in the past of keeping competitive, if you will. Not at the top, but certainly able to recruit people.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Suluk, welcome. Obviously, this is a passion for you, and we appreciate your commitment to it. And I've learned more here in the last hour than I in this area that I've learned in a very long time. I have several questions, if you'll indulge me, Madam Chair. The first one, Dr. Suluk, is the southwest corner. I would assume that's all areas, all those services are taken care of privately by private organizations. And at the same time, you can maybe, I live in the South Central area, in the Fairmont area. I'm looking at Rice County, and there it's just chock full with residential services. Is that funding through the county? So two questions there. What's happening in southwest corner of the state? And two, how's the funding situation with all these services? And why is one county full of residential? I mean, there's such a disparity there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to ask Mr. Tesner to comment specifically on the location of these programs across the state, because there's some history that goes back quite some time with the closing of the regional treatment centers and some agreements and negotiations that were made to be able to open some programming and facilities in specific areas. Before you make that comment,
after this question, I'd like to get back to the presentation because I want to make sure you get finished with it and that we have some time for questions at the end.
Sure. Going back to the slide outlining the array of services, if you think about inpatient and then residential and partial, we have a vision that we can be looking regionally across the state and trying to find out where there's some specific gaps and what our role is to either work to fill those gaps or partner with community providers to make sure that those gaps are filled. I think there are certainly gaps in the state currently geographically and programmatically, and that's what we're working to try to fill. Specifically, the history, if you could comment on that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, over the last 20 years of downsizing the regional centers, many agreements, both on the labor side and also legislative direction, really has caused clustering around where the institutions used to be. So in Rice County, Faribault Regional Center was there, and there's a lot of residential services that were driven by those types of agreements. But that's the history, as Dr. Suluk's pointing out. What we're looking at now is really, and we actually did this in the establishment of the community behavioral health hospitals. Those are really located in community centers where there's also health care and other infrastructure that we needed, not necessarily just where the institution was housed for decades or more. But as Dr. Suluk's pointing out, at this point, as we're looking at these array of services, we really need to look at where the gaps are geographically as well as clinically and service-wise, what the private sector is willing to do out there versus what we need to do. So I think you'll see a greater dispersion towards where the gaps exist rather than the geography of the old institutional system.
And Madam Chair, I will save my other two questions till later, but one is dealing with the mandates. And if the department has been working on areas of mandates that they can bring to us, that Senator
Lynch's
subcommittee.
Well, of course, people that are in the MITO program are the ultimate mandate. They've been committed to the state by the courts. So that's sort of the ultimate mandate, I would say.
Madam Chair, I think
But that doesn't mean that that couldn't have been prevented. I mean, to me, it says that there's been a lack of appropriate level of service for some time if we've gotten to the point where someone has had to be committed by the courts.
Madam Chair, I guess I was thinking more in the line of paperwork.
Extra. Yeah, well, I think that is a good question for the end if we have time. You skipped a slide. I'm a little concerned about that.
I'm going to ask us to go all the way back to slide number 10. I don't know if these are numbered in front of you, but if we just this slide is immediately after
page
that level
five.
Of care slide. If you go back to this particular slide, let me just walk us through the specific information about MEDO. First of all, the reclarification of our role. As we've been discussing here, the role of the state is to provide care for those individuals with a developmental disability and a severe behavioral dysregulation disorder or problem that has gotten them to the point where they have been in trouble and ultimately then committed to the state. Now, as Madam Chair had indicated, to rely solely on some type of intensive inpatient or locked secured facility is an inappropriate therapeutic model to be thinking about. And that's not where we want to rely on and see our only role. Our role is to provide care in this end of the spectrum, but there's really some significant gaps. There's been significant gaps in providing appropriate intensive inpatient psychiatric services for young adults and adults with developmental disabilities. We see that we can help provide some cushion to the entire system of care in the state as we specialize in that area. We also need to be able to step patients out of a more secure setting like MEDO into more community-based residential programs, and then also being able to have a mobile crisis and community support system that is more integrated across the state so that these individuals can effectively integrate back into a community setting and receive the support that they require in order to stay there and stay out of the inpatient or other higher levels of care within the state system. Walking through some specific points, I'm going to ask Mr. Tesner if he would take over and just kind of walk us through these slides.
And once again, these came out of the Ombudsman's work with the program, the Department of Health citations, as well as the consultation with this group of experts. And the use of mechanical restraints has ended this past fall, and now mechanical restraints can only be used per physician order in emergency situations, as Dr. Suick alluded earlier. The staff have now been trained in the positive behavioral supports, which will intervene earlier with individuals and lessen the reliance on more aggressive control procedures. And we are using timeout to manage individuals who present that imminent risk of harm. Any questions on those pages?
Are there questions on this slide? I wondered if you could say a little more about this pillager site.
Yes.
Yes. Actually, moving to page 13, slide 13. One of the problems when we start to peel this apart and to understand how MEDO got in this predicament, the over-reliance on the use of restraints, we have individuals that were being committed to the care of the commissioner who were mentally retarded, but did not rise to the level of needing the type of program offered at the MEDO program. However, MEDO had ICFMR beds, and we were intending to have them stay in those beds on a short-term basis. Many of those individuals have stayed months or years and inappropriately served in that level of care. We've established a site at Pillager, which will be opening the first or second week of February, that really is intended to be a transitional service. It's adult foster care. It's a four-bed home. It's located in the immediate proximity of a day training rehabilitation site that we operate so that essentially people will go there. Average length of stay we're expecting will be 90 days or less. So they will be stabilized, brought there, plans for their return to their home community will be implemented, and then they would return to their home community. that means essentially what will happen is the utilization of Meto as a long-term alternative for that group of people who don't rise to the Meto, that core population they were intended to serve, would not be spending time at Meto.
And would that facility be eligible to receive federal reimbursement?
It will. Individuals going in there would be waiver eligible, and it's our intent that it'll operate in that system.
And do you know what the daily per diem will be?
Madam Chair, I do not, but I can get you that information.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Tessner, where is Pillager?
In beautiful north central Minnesota, about 25 miles west of Brainerd.
And how large a facility is it?
It'll be a four-bed site. If you look at the people, the number of folks coming into the Meto program over the last several years who fit that description, and if you expect, and we do, that their stay there will be short and they'll be returned to their home community, four beds should be enough. In the event that it's not, then we would need to look at opening another site. But the intent is not to put people in the wrong level of care, if you will, at the Meto program, but to get them into the right level of care.
Mr. Tessmer, would the location that you have at Pillager allow you to serve more than four individuals?
Madam Chair, it would not.
Okay.
So I could add that it's a model that if it shows to be really effective and allows us to maybe avoid patients having to come into Meto, but also to be able to transition out of Meto effectively, then there's certainly the ability to expand that model to other parts of the state to serve these individuals. I'll point out a concern I have, and I don't have data to support this as of yet, but I would like to know this information because I'm worried about our aging population. And my experience clinically has been that there's a tremendous number of adults with developmental disabilities who are continuing to live with their aging parents. And as their aging parents are getting to the point where they themselves are not able to sustain living in their own home, much less care for their developmentally disabled adult child, then I think we are going to see over the next decade a significant rise of crisis of these individuals. And I see this as an opportunity for us to really think with our community providers as well about how to work together to have a much better system of care for these individuals.
Senator Coring, did you have a question?
Well,
on this Pillager site?
Madam Chair, Mr. Tessner, so we're in relation to where that day center is. I know where the day center is. I've been there in Pillager. Whereabouts is that facility then?
It's in that neighborhood.
It is?
I've been there too, but it's been a couple of years, and I think you can see the DTNH from the home.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Coring.
Mr. Tessner, what is the difference between this facility and the facility in Baxter? What? Why wouldn't these people, or these folks be served?
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, the program in Baxter is an acute inpatient adult mental health program. Okay. Average length of stay runs about 20 days. The Pillager site is licensed now as an adult foster care site, corporate foster care, 24-hour staffing. So, and these are people who don't need acute inpatient care. They do need 24-hour monitoring, supervision, and support, but not acute inpatient psychiatric.
90 days.
That's our intention, yes.
I see.
Okay. Continue.
And the last bullet is we began a process last summer within the department with the Disability Services Division, State Operated Services, and an array of community crisis providers looking at, as well as county persons or county social service agency staff, looking at the need for a more robust crisis service system. And as I alluded to before, the community services or community support services that State Operated Services operate has a great track record of intervening earlier, training providers up, keeping people stable where they're at, or expediting admissions when that's necessary. So in those conversations, we're looking at, you know, what the private sector can do, what we need to be doing. doing to make sure that people that are admitted to the Meadow program or the Pillager site or other places in state-operated services, that that's the level of care that they need. And then it isn't simply de facto that nothing else exists, and therefore we'll commit them to the state for care.
Just as an example, I'll take a moment to speak about another area of care just to give you an example of what we're doing across each of these centers of care. It's trying to really examine where the gaps in the entire array of services needed in the state are and what our role is to help provide care within those gaps. In the Child and Adolescent Specialty Care Center, when we look specifically at the services across the state and where we're really needing some specialized care services, it is in the area of neurodevelopmental disorders. It is in the area of the children and adolescents with developmental disabilities, with profound behavioral dysregulation disorders, autism and behavioral dysregulation disorders. It's in the area of severely traumatized children and in the area of severe emotional dysregulation disorders. Those areas are currently being developed within CABS to become the specialized center of care within the state to provide the high-end level of care for individuals with these particular problems. Within the developmental and disability arena, I see us having the same role in providing a portion of the care, but not assuming the entire spectrum of care, but providing a portion of the care that aligns with what fits best within our specific mission of providing care for the most complex. The last slide that I'm going to show you is this one, which is basically, as we go through a transformation within these services, know that these are the things that we clearly identify as the specific steps and action steps needed for the development of new services. We need to be examining the licensing and accreditation, which we are beginning the process across the entire system. I'm bringing a model of coding and billing that is different than what state-operated services has experienced previously, having come from the private sector. And I'm applying the requirement to have us look specifically at every service we provide to see where there's opportunities to better code and better bill, improving the revenue stream coming back into the system. Looking at our current staffing patterns, with every model of lower level of care not requiring inpatient or residential, we have to look at housing and transportation options to make certain that regionally patients are able to get access to the care as we can provide. And looking specifically at allowing some standardization in the quality and the applications of therapeutic programming, and specifically across the entire areas, looking at our role in establishing community partnership and building the community relations. So I just want to give you the idea that these are the action steps that are currently underway in each of these centers of care, not only in Meadow. And that's the last portion of information we wanted to present to you, and we're open for further questions.
One of the questions that I've been asking that didn't get answered in your presentation is, there were beds that were decertified at Meadow. That means that they no longer are certified for Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement. And that did cause a couple $1 million extra budget deficit during this biennium. And I don't understand the reason for decertifying those beds. I don't understand it either programmatically or financially.
Madam Chair, as I alluded to before, individuals who are eligible for ICFMR level of care don't fit the Meadow population, the target population. We went through a protracted debate, certification and decertification process with both the Minnesota Department of Health and the Center for Medicaid Services, Medicaid Medicare Services, including appeals of those decisions. And ultimately what we were told is that the individuals that Meadow is typically is targeted to serve do not rise to that ICFMR level of care. And in essence, the opening of the Pillager home is going to be moving those individuals who are eligible for that level of care into waivered services, so they will be drawing down those federal dollars, but they won't be doing it at the Meadow program. Now, having said that, moving in the direction that Dr.
Well, are the beds then that were decertified being discontinued at the MEDO program? Or is the intention to fill those beds with other individuals?
Madam Chair, it's our intent, looking at Dr. Sulik's description of those stratified levels of care, is to develop those other levels of care that are appropriate to the MEDO population so we don't have people coming in who really don't need to be there, or that we can move them through the program more quickly or divert them to more appropriate placements and ensure that to the extent that it's possible, drawing down federal participation. So crisis service intervention, which we know for individuals with developmental disabilities, there's a waiver service that pays for it. And residentially, like the Pillager site, perhaps more sites that are serving individuals in that foster care system.
I don't mean this question to be taken the wrong way. I think you're moving in the right direction here. But you didn't answer my question about the beds at MITO, at the Cambridge site. They were decertified. Are they going to be discontinued then at the Cambridge site?
Madam Chair,
or are they going to be filled with other individuals? So you have this Pillager site, and then you have the MEDO site with just as many people as you had before you started.
Madam
Chair,
Pillager
site.
We're in the process of designing this new system. It is our intent that there will be fewer people served at MEDO for shorter lengths of time, so there would be fewer beds filled in the MEDO program.
So I'm going to answer that more succinctly. They're going to be discontinued at MEDO. So in other words, the total bed census at MEDO is decreasing because we have the vision of having a much better array of services where patients, we project not to have the same number of required individuals requiring that intensive level of long-term care at MEDO.
Beginning when?
I don't have the answer for a specific timeline to give you a specific concrete, meaningful date, but know that we have plans. The Pillager program opens in February, correct? And if we see that we're able to do that very successfully, I can assure you that the vision of applying that model across the state will be presented back to you within the next couple of months.
The reason I'm asking this question is because if the beds are intended to be discontinued this biennium, we wouldn't have a couple million dollar more budget deficit. They would have been decertified. We'd lose the federal funding. But we also wouldn't need then to replace the federal funding with state funding. Do you understand my question?
Madam Chair, I don't understand. You're right, we would lose the federal
dollars.
The
reason that we have an increase in the deficit when we decertified the beds and lost the federal funding is because we were anticipating replacing that federal funding with state funding. Well, if the real goal is to discontinue the bed entirely, there would be a savings, not an increase in the deficit.
Madam Chair, I understand your question. The intent is to take those dollars now dedicated to inpatient care at MEDO and spend them on for example, without having the plan in place, this is just an example, expanding community support services, putting a crisis service component in there so that people who need that level of care can get access to it without going through civil commitment into the MEDO program. So it's intended to take the dollars that will not be utilized because we've shifted to this new Pillager model and reinvest that at the front door, for example.
It still seems to me that, A, you're reducing your length of stay at the facility. You had an individual who had been living there for 13 years that's been, placed elsewhere. If you're reducing your length of stay and you're relying more on community-based alternatives that draw down federal financing, it should be changing the budget outlook for MEDO, and we should not be increasing the deficit. We should be reducing it.
And, Madam Chair, I think in the end that will be what happens, because if we are developing more sites like Pillager, for example, we are drawing down those federal dollars.
Madam Chair, if I could make a comment. You're raising two very valid points. That what I would like to do is I'd like to go back and re-examine our projections in our particular budget forecasts specific to this facility and demonstrate to you where we see that it's either going to reduce or being reapplied to these lower levels of care that need to be created in order to make the system work more efficiently. But we can bring that back to you.
Right, but we're talking about the rest of this biennium. And we're expecting another projected deficit and perhaps more on allotment before June. You know, the Tom Stinson was talking about maybe another $200 million. So if you're going to be having a reduction this biennium, I think it would be important to know that rather than simply, you know, taking money out of other programs so that you can have it in case something happens. I mean, if you're not going to be creating any more programs like Pillager this biennium, that means before June of this year, then the reduction in your expenditures should be reflected in your bottom line for this biennium, not be transferred to the front door to create more services this biennium. Does that make sense?
Makes sense. And okay. We'll examine that and bring that back to you. Absolutely.
I would appreciate that. Other questions? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Sulik, in your transformation implementation, you've identified a number of areas that you're working on, and that's terrific. I wonder, it seems to me that we're maybe missing one bullet, though, and that would be with regard to quality and patient safety. I get an awful lot of questions, frankly, from families with regard to MEDO specifically, and I think that branches further out into the other state-operated services. So when you're thinking about your transformation, what are you doing or what kind of assurance can you give to the committee? What kind of assurance can you give to families, to Minnesotans, that what transpired at MEDO isn't happening in other facilities? I don't see that's part of your plan, and I presume that it is. So if you'd care to comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator. Actually, really an excellent and insightful question, and I think that it certainly warrants some explanation that this transformational vision does require, in the words that you use, very stringent oversight. And I think the process of reassigning the clinical leads to me, to having that direct reporting structure to me, provides me the initiation of that oversight. The second piece is we've just launched, as of yesterday, a work group within each of these seven goals, one of them being qualities of care, the goal number three, where there's a work group being assigned of members from every single care center across the system, and also members from our policy divisions working together to come up with the plan of intervention to allow us to be operationalizing action steps to make sure that we can best achieve these goals in as timely a manner as possible. That particular piece provides yet another way of me getting access to ongoing data about how things are changing and improving across the system. The level of care data that I presented is an example of us examining ourselves on an ongoing basis, where what I'm asking for and what I'm finding like never before is the level of sophistication that I have access to within the system is really quite extraordinary. So when I ask for a level of care assessment to be done across the system, it actually happens in an extraordinarily timely manner. So I was able to get this data within less than a week after asking for it. And I think I'm reassured that I have access to some significant talent and support across the system. The talent and support across the system is being given new questions that that may not have been asked historically, that will continue to be asked. And I think we're going to be able to provide some reassurance, not only to me, but to you all as well as to the people of Minnesota, that that way of examining ourselves, looking specific, committing to outcomes analysis, committing to looking ongoing, how are we achieving reduction in symptoms and improvement in functioning of each and every patient that comes into our care? That's part of our mission now.
And Senator Lynch, I think while the commissioner didn't need to do this, he did it by way of example in his presentation. The fact that he took time to put together for us information about the analysis of the level of care needs of patients at Anoka, even though this hearing was about Mito, is an example of how the same type of approach needs to be used there, where we need to be developing other services that can serve people at a more appropriate level of care. And so, obviously we don't have indefinite amount of time here just to keep going on and on. I wish we did, but there have been many times when I have had discussions with this part of the department about increased expenditures that I thought maybe shouldn't be necessary. And oftentimes where the discussion has led us is, well, we can't get people back out in the community because of the county for one reason or another. And I have said to them, then we need to develop the service ourselves, because we can't be relying on somebody else in the chain of command here that isn't doing something that needs to be done that is driving up our budget. And I believe that. I mean, that is partly what state-operated services does. They fill the voids in the system to make sure that people can get served appropriately. We would like the counties to be doing that, but if we can't always count on them to do that for whatever reason, then we need to do it. And so I think, that is probably a further discussion that we need to have in regard to the service needs of people that are being seen at Anoka. Other questions? Senator Rosen.
This is a completely different question, but I would like to ask the assistant commissioner if I could. Are we done with the state-operated services, do you think?
Well, I don't know. Are there other questions anybody has? I guess we are.
At some time, would like to have a discussion about if you're being involved with the issue around short-term offenders that suffer from a mental and medical condition and what it means to our counties. There are some discussions that are going on between the Sheriff's Association and the medical community, but I was just wondering where the department and where you're at. Are you a part of those discussions, and is there any relief in that area coming down the pipeline?
Madam Chair and Senator, I've not been involved in any discussions as of yet in that regard. I have a tremendous interest in that area and certainly would be very welcome to, I'd be very open to participating in those dialogues, but I've not been part of them thus far.
But it is just one example of why we need to think very, very carefully before we do things like, say, we can eliminate maintenance of effort for mental health.
Madam Chair, unintended consequences, I think, is the key word here. And I do agree with your comment earlier about taking a look at programs and seeing how we could do better with them. Not necessarily just saying they have to go, but is there some combinations, revamping, just a general business attitude towards running it more smoothly? And that's where I would like this committee to go.
Right. So if you have some ideas on that, Senator Rosen, please. I'm not kidding. I've said to people, and this is kind of what keeps me going these days, is if I can get a new idea a day, I avoid a panic attack.
Well, Madam Chair, okay, the short-term offender issue, we will be cutting counties. So again, I mean, that's just coming down the pipeline. And that is and anybody out here, in we're all greater Minnesota legislators, that is a huge expense on our counties. And if we can give them some relief, and I don't know enough about the issue.
Well, Senator Rosen, if you think we have a problem now, just stop and think what's going to happen if we eliminate general assistance medical care from our budget when we have 40% of the people in the program suffering from mental illness.
Well, that was kind of a twist there, Madam Chair. I still kind of wanted to concentrate on short-term offenders, but well, I think that if there's some way
what I can say about that is that I don't have that in my budget division. I wish I did, because I think there are huge linkages between health and human services and corrections. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't the decision that was made about how to structure the Senate committee. So
you used to.
We used to have it. Yes, we did, and you remember that. And I think we did make some good progress in serving, in better serving and better discharging prisoners with mental illness when we had that in our division. But so that should be a question you hold for this afternoon.
That's
right. Other questions for these gentlemen? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As long as we're moving more generally kind of away from the specific topic and kind of a, as a follow-up to the comment you made about the maintenance of effort issue that the counties are raising, I guess I'm just wondering, when we got the response from the counties, I think it was last week, the memo went out with their suggestions for mandates they would like to see removed. I'm wondering, I sent that back to the mental health community in my district for their input, and I've gotten some responses back now I'd be happy to share with you. But it seemed like a lot of those points that were in that, those recommendations specifically related to the area of mental health. And I'm wondering if the assistant commissioner has had an opportunity to review those recommendations and has any feelings about them. And I guess my concern or my initial reaction is because in Beltrami County, for example, the community mental health center there is really struggling. And I'm trying to get a feeling for, you know, what the problems are, but it seems like there are some problems between the county and the community mental health center. I'm concerned about if a mandate is viewed or if an outcome is, if the discussion is structured so that if we have mental health issues in a community or substance abuse issues in a community, that that's going to be viewed as a failure by the people working in that system as opposed to a symptom of some larger socioeconomic issues that we're dealing with surrounding poverty and that we would be somehow providing less services or less funding to those areas that might need the most. You know, I'm concerned about moving in that direction versus the difference between that and making sure that we are, in fact, utilizing best practices as far as things that work versus those that don't work and that we're putting our money in, we're utilizing our money in the best possible way. And I think that is going to come back as an issue kind of repeatedly this session. I think
you're right, Senator Olson, and that's why I did raise the example of general assistance medical care, because very likely if we're not treating people with mental illness in clinics, we will be having them in jail. And I can tell you that it isn't cheaper to put them in jail.
Or homeless or, you know, other things that we don't want to see happening. So I guess I'm just wondering if the department's involved in that discussion and has any reactions or recommendations or will be having some in relation to those recommendations from the county. Counties.
Madam Chair and Senator, can I ask for a clarification? When you mentioned a report, you were specifically
referring to? It's not a report. It's a letter.
Yeah. It was a letter.
I think it was a letter to Senator Lynch's subcommittee that's been looking at mandates.
looking at the county mandates.
They had a list of recommendations that they'd like us to consider in terms of removing mandates.
Understood.
And some of it gets intertwined with the maintenance of effort issue, and some of it was other things that were more administrative in nature.
To clarify then, I have been involved in some conversations about the maintenance of effort discussion, and the particularly around the mental health maintenance of efforts. Given the light of the expected rise in mental health needs within the state of Minnesota, particularly in times of the projected economic crisis, we have significant concerns about the maintenance of effort going away. And so, and that's the stance that we've been able to take, and as a result of very stringent discussions and dialogues at the within the Department of Human Services. I think that we're certainly open to reexamining how that formula has been arrived and how to make it much more meaningful in a way of thinking. But we really need the counties to be working with us to provide some portion of the care. And that's the stance that we've been taking thus far. I share your concerns and the comments that you've made, certainly.
Other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Doctor. And just to follow up on that, I'm just wondering if those conversations are, or if you have a reaction at this point to, I think the governor's recommendation sounded as though he was wanting to move toward maybe reducing administrative costs through more regionalization of the providing of those services. And do you have any thoughts about that recommendation?
Madam Chair and Senator, that discussion is live currently. And so I don't have any specific results from that discussion. But as we've been involved in that, we're seeing potential increase in significant cost savings if we can arrive at some better collaboration and sharing of resources across the different counties. So I think philosophically and logically as we look at this, that direction seems to make some sense to us.
And Senator Olson, I might just add that there has been an ongoing legislatively created kind of working group between the House and Senate. It's called the Committee on Administrative Simplification. And it came out of the legislative auditor's report a couple years ago about the unevenness of services across the state and the disparity in of counties' abilities to provide services. Mm-hmm. And that group is hoping to have a wrap-up meeting before we get deeper into the session, and it is planned to be over a couple of years that we would be meeting. And there are some areas that they've been looking at in terms of trying to regionalize more of the services. I think our next meeting we'll have a presentation on potential regionalization of estate recovery, for example, because some of our small counties maybe have an estate recovery once every 5 years. Well, it's pretty hard to have a staff person that's really on top of it. And that's not even to mention that if you've seen one estate recovery, you've seen one estate recovery. They're all different. And so through regionalization, it might be possible to create more expertise. And in this area, for example, perhaps to be able to generate more recovery. So I'm sure that discussion can unfold in a number of ways in a number of places. I know some of the counties that serve on the group really struggle with providing chemical dependency services. We've had discussions about that because of the sparsity of their population and the inability to have services located very close to the people that need to be served. And so I think it's a rich discussion that we'll continue to be having. Other questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's just a comment that I got to thinking when I first got on this committee how very little attention was placed on mental health. And now it's very enlightening and positive to see the direction. We have an assistant commissioner who obviously has a wide expanse of experience in this area and the direction that we're going. So I'm trying to look at it as half full.
I know that more needs to be done. I hear about it wherever I go, but I don't want anybody to ever forget the $34 million that we invested in mental health 2 years ago when we had very little to invest. And that was a priority area, and it wasn't just the money. It was also a restructuring of how services are delivered was a part of that package. So,
and Madam Chair, the whole thinking that mental health is so critical in chemical dependency issues and in every aspect of that. That whole shift in thinking how important mental health is. So I appreciate your testimony, Assistant Commissioner.
Other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much, and good luck with your efforts.
Thank you very much.
I was just thinking with their timeline was unknown, that just every day.
Now we're starting to pull up a little bit.